You're with SBS Radio.
Wow.
We're on your side. If you have a go, you'll get a go.
Better hospitals over bigger banks.
Wow.
The insurgents were not rewarded.
We've lost the Prime Minister, but there is still a government to save.
I know you miss me. I know you want me back.
You're an international embarrassment.
Mr. Speaker, it's like Game of Thrones, but without all the good bits.
I think it's a joke. I know. Ooh. Careful there, honey.
It's all a big mess of dogs droppings. Unless someone gets a shovel out.
See ya.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason in the gallery for SBS World News. What a week it's been for Prime Minister Scott Morrison, chalking up the biggest ever by-election swing in Australian history.
What has happened here in Wentworth is not unexpected. Liberals are angry, and they've expressed that.
Only to be tearfully embraced on the lawns of Parliament, having delivered an historic apology to victims and survivors of institutional child sexual abuse.
I've never felt such pain and hurt in one room ever. And it just grieves your soul to your core.
We sat down for an exclusive interview with Scott Morrison as he welcomes state premiers and chief ministers to Canberra for a drought summit, pledging billions of dollars for Australian farmers battling the big dry.
Do you need to do one of them?
Yes.
Prime Ministerial clap, you don't get that every day.
Prime Minister, welcome back to SBS.
Thanks, Brett.
It's been a big week.
Have you even for one moment thought about how much easier life would be for everyone if Malcolm Turnbull was still Prime Minister?
Leaders always step up regardless of the circumstances. And leadership requires you to do that without guarantees about the future. But I'm not planning on being here for just 6 months.
On your first day as Prime Minister, you said that the drought was your number one priority. What can we expect from this drought summit?
Well, one of the things that has become clear, and when I first went up to Quilpie, what struck me was the resilience, because they've been in it for 6 years, and the hope that was there and the determination. And so there will always be droughts in Australia. And what has struck me over that period of time is we needed to build resilience for the future. And so to establish a future drought fund, which actually takes some of the capital that we have and builds it over time and uses that to prepare us for future droughts and to draw down during future droughts, I think is a way of giving Australians in rural and regional areas confidence that the government is planning for the future, planning for future droughts, and I think that gives them confidence to plan for them themselves and make their own investments. We're doing that as a government, and I think that backs in what farmers do.
How much is the future fund, and how will it impact farmers who are dealing with the drought right now?
Well, right now, a lot of the assistance that is provided is out of the current budget. So it was $1.8 billion of investments that have been made, and that's everything through Farm Household Assistant and it's another programs. The drought Future Drought Fund starts at $3.9 billion. It assigns capital that has previously been in another fund, and it puts it to the purpose of drought. It'll build up to $5 billion, and each year we'll be able to draw down around $100 million from the earnings of that fund, which will go into drought resistance projects, drought resilience projects, water projects, things of that nature, which builds up our capacity to cope with future droughts. So, because we're dealing with a drought, there's the immediate relief, and there are people in trouble, they need help, and it's the Commonwealth Government's responsibility to look after the people.
The drought's your number one domestic priority. The new member for Wentworth and the crossbench have said that their number one domestic political priority is getting kids off Nauru.
Mm.
What do you say to them?
Well, our form is that we've been getting the children off Nauru for years. And more importantly, we haven't been putting more children on Nauru. You don't get kids off Nauru by putting more on with policies that lead to kids getting on boats again. And no one understands that better than our government, because we've had success. I mean, we've got 8,000 children out of detention. We've closed 17 detention centres. We've ensured that we've restored the integrity of Australia's borders, which means these lethal trips are no longer being taken. And the number of children on Nauru has been falling. I mean, over 200 children are already off Nauru, and we're now down to a figure of just over 50, and we're continuing to work, particularly through our United States agreement, to reducing those numbers even further. So, we'll continue to make that practical progress, because it is our goal to ensure that we can get the children off Nauru.
The New Zealand deal seemed to be on the table this week. Labor on the crossbench said to the gallery that they were prepared to negotiate. Then that deal seemed to disappear. What happened?
They weren't prepared to support the bill. That's part of the problem.
They were prepared to negotiate.
Well, you don't negotiate your borders. You don't do that. I mean, you don't get to negotiate with people smugglers. You have to have very clear and unambiguous policies. And this is the problem that often happens in this place. They don't understand that these issues are dealt with in very absolute terms. And unless you're very clear about where your borders are and how you manage them, then the people smugglers, they take you all the way. They just take you all the way, and they eventually can get the ventures underway, and you're back where you started again, and you're putting more children on Nauru. So there are problems with the New Zealand approach of being a pull factor, because as we've already learnt, there are those on Nauru who are starting to say, oh, I mightn't take the US option, I might have a better option in Australia. And so that has been complicating our efforts to actually get more children off Nauru.
You talk about it being something that can't be negotiated. Aren't we at a stage where it must be negotiated?
Did you know, when I became minister 5 years ago, the previous government had put pregnant women on Manus Island. I mean, that's what was happening. That had to stop. And the Labor Party put children on Manus Island. I mean, that was mad policy. And so we put an end to all of that. We closed detention centres. We got the borders under control, and we're getting children off Nauru, and we will continue to do it. But it's not a bargaining chip. It's not a negotiation. It's just a practical task we're getting done.
Realistically, when do you think the last children will leave Nauru?
Well, we're working hard on that.
You made your first big foreign policy announcement just before the Wentworth by-election that Australia was...
I didn't. I gave my first major speech on international affairs in Indonesia a week after coming into the job, when I visited Indonesia. And that was my first foray into international politics, meeting with President Widodo and ensuring that we're able to secure closing off the final stage of negotiations on what is a very big trade agreement for Australia.
Your first announcement in terms of policy, where you said that you were willing to reconsider or re-look at Australia's support of the Iran nuclear deal. You're also potentially or open to reconsidering recognising Jerusalem as the Israeli capital. Mm. Given the result of the Wentworth by-election, was that a bad call?
It wasn't about the Wentworth by-election. There was a vote in the United Nations General Assembly on that week. And that dealt with the chair of the G77, and Australia was being called on to vote. Now, on many of these votes in the past, Australia has abstained, and that wasn't my view. I believed we should vote, and we should oppose, and we did. And in that context, where we were making effectively a statement on that question, the other questions which are very significant around those issues are the Iran nuclear deal and its effectiveness, and the other issue is the issue of the capital. Now, on the first issue on Iran, what we said is we were going to review without prejudice, and that review is now underway, being led by the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, about whether it's getting the job done. It's been just over 3 years, and there are questions about its effectiveness, and we'll consider its effectiveness and come to a view, and that will go through the normal process. On the question of the capital, look, there are very few, if any, countries around the world where we don't recognise the capital of the nation being what the nation itself recognises. Now, we've always been committed to a two-state solution. I'm committed to a two-state solution. You know what? We're not much closer to it. In fact, we're no closer to it. And we've maintained the orthodoxies of these positions, which says, oh, you're not allowed to talk about what the capital should be. And in fact, you've seen that here in the Parliament. Apparently, you can't even ask the question here without the sorts of commentary we've had from others. I mean, the government hasn't made a decision to do this. All I simply said is, I'm open to the possibility that you could do this, recognise the capital of Israel as Jerusalem, and at the same time do that with the mutual objective of a two-state solution. So I'm prepared to try things differently to get that outcome. I think doing the things the same way as they've always been done is not getting us anywhere.
You've asked the question, when will we get an answer? Were we talking days, weeks, months?
No, this will be considered over months, many months. And it'll be considered carefully, and we'll go through all the normal processes you'd expect it to. And as we go into the summit season, amongst many other issues, it's one of the topics that I'll obviously discuss with other leaders.
Going into summit season, you'll be at ASEAN and APEC. This will be your first chance to meet world leaders on the world stage at a summit. We've seen you with the big stick out in question time today. Are you going to bash China with it? They've been a pretty bad neighbour, haven't they?
No, I disagree with both of those comments. We have an outstanding relationship with China, like we do with other partners in the region, Japan, Southeast Asia nations, and through ASEAN, but particularly nations like Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia. And Australia is about managing all of those relationships. We have our own sovereign views on all questions, just like all of our neighbours have their sovereign views on their questions. I don't enter into debates about what other countries should think about these other topics. I consider that their sovereign right to have whatever the view they have about any questions. So no, we will work obviously constructively with China, as we always have. They're our biggest trading partner and will continue to be that. And our futures are very much intertwined in the region, and the future peace, stability and prosperity of all of our citizens very much depend, I think, on those productive relationships.
What about the South China Sea? Aren't you worried about China's conduct?
No, Australia's just a very measured partner. And we engage with our partners and major trading partners in particular, I think, in a very practical way. And we seek to have those discussions when we wish to raise issues, I think, in a very respectful way and in the appropriate forums. And we'll just continue to do that. We're about reducing tensions, not escalating them, and maintaining the dialogue.
Looking ahead to APEC, Australia's been a big supporter of Papua New Guinea hosting that.
Yeah.
Is part of that reasserting Australia's friendship and influence in the region? We've seen China investing a lot of small Pacific nations. Is that concerning for Australia? Should Australians be worried about that?
One of my most, arguably my most important international objective is actually doing the right thing in our own home patch. And our relationship with the Pacific is incredibly important to me. Whether it's Papua New Guinea, or I was just meeting just last week with the Prime Minister of Fiji, Frank Bainimarama, who's going through an election at the moment, and I've been meeting with other Pacific leaders. And at that APEC event, I've also invited them all around for a barbecue up there in Moresby at the residence. And I'm reaching out to our brothers and sisters in the Pacific. I think together with New Zealand, and in New Zealand they call it whanau, that is our approach, I think, to the Pacific. We will always be there. There's a kinship that I want to reinforce as Prime Minister, and a very direct and honest and open embrace of our friends in the Pacific. And now, that's economic, it's social, it's strategic, it's all of these things. And so whether our seasonal workers program, or how we're working together on security issues in the Pacific, the Pacific Patrol Boats program, the BlackRock initiative in Fiji, there are a range of different investments and programs we're pursuing in the region. And they know we're not just a partner of choice, we're family.
Julian Assange is someone the Australian government hasn't spoken about for quite some time. He's actually suing Ecuador and faces the prospect of being thrown out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London. If he were to be sought for extradition by the United States, would you intervene?
No, I haven't really applied myself to that question. It's not one that's really burning a hole in my agenda at the moment. If he finds himself in that situation, he would have got himself into quite a pickle.
Do you feel for Mr. Assange, given his Australian passport was taken away? He's been in the Ecuadorian embassy for some years now, an Australian citizen.
Well, Australian citizens can always expect to receive the support that Australian citizens are provided with. But people also have to take responsibility for their actions when they're abroad. And, you know, we deal with this as members of parliament all the time. Often we find Australians overseas who can find themselves in a bit of difficulty. And, you know, Australians aren't immune from the laws of the countries they're visiting. And they have to respect those laws and behave consistent with those. And so no one gets a leave pass because they're an Australian. But they will always get the support all Australians should expect when they're overseas as citizens.
Do you think he should be prosecuted for publishing leaked US
Again, I'm not really getting into it. It's not something that I'm focusing on.
As Treasury, your path to surplus relied on annual net permanent migration of 190,000 a year. Is that a figure the government's sticking to?
Well, the path to surplus didn't rely on that. It relied on good, sound financial management.
There was a part of that process, though, migration.
Well, we've seen the numbers fall to just over 160. And I think that's consistent with where the demand is in, and we remain completely rock solid on our path back to surplus in 2019-20. And that's a year ahead of the original projection when I came to the job 3 years ago as Treasurer. So it plays a part, but what's important is that you have a migration program that does the job that Australians need it to do. Now, in parts of the country, like in the Northern Territory, in North Queensland, over in Western Australia, South Australia, Tasmania, they are all places where state and territory governments are very keen to see more people. In Sydney and in Melbourne, in particular parts of Sydney and Melbourne, I think there is the very opposite view. And so what I want the migration program to do is back in the population plans and policies that state and territory governments have, because at the end of the day, people want to go where the jobs and the services are. And so where state and territory governments have an appetite for actually embracing and supporting populations, well, that's a pretty good place for them to go. In places where that's under strain, like in Sydney and Melbourne, the central coast of New South Wales and places like that, well, you know, we've got to look at alternative models. So there's no such thing as average population growth or average migration intake. I mean, it's different in every part of the country, just like rainfall. There's no such thing as average rainfall falling all over the country. It falls differently in different parts of the country and is needed in different parts of the country in different ways.
On your first day as Prime Minister, you told us that you wanted to bring all Australians together. But in recent times in Canberra, we've had a motion in the Senate supported by the government that says it's okay to be white. We've had another senator talk about the final solution in terms of migration. And the Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton, has talked repeatedly about gangs of African youths in Melbourne. Do you think that those types of things here in Canberra help to bring Australians together?
Well, look, I think people focus a bit too much on, frankly, what everybody says in Canberra. I think they're more interested in what we do in Canberra in terms of getting unemployment down and in funding essential services in health and education and ensuring that we're getting taxes lower, which is what we're legislating, and making sure we're passing the legislation to support major trade agreements like the TPP11, which has gone through the Parliament. You know, these are the things that actually matter. I mean, Canberra can be a bit of a debating society, from time to time, probably a bit too much often, and people can pay a bit too much attention. I mean, but when outrageous things are said, they should be called out and they should be decried, and I have done that and ministers have done that. Australia's migrant communities have built the country. I mean, it's been one of the key pillars of Australia's prosperity over generations. And one of the reasons I was so strong on border protection, yes, it was to stop the horrible deaths at sea, and yes, it was to protect the integrity of Australia's borders, but it was also about protecting the confidence that Australians had in our immigration program and migrants coming to Australia. And you know who has been one of the most biggest supporters of my policies on border protection? Have been migrant communities themselves, because they know how wonderful Australia is and they know how important the immigration program is, and they want its integrity to be protected.
SBS began broadcasting 38 years ago this week. Yeah. How important do you think the Special Broadcasting Service has been in bringing all parts of Australia together and reflecting the voices and faces of all Australians?
Well, it's a Liberal initiative. It was started by Malcolm Fraser. It was started by a coalition government, like many initiatives. I mean, it was the Liberal Party that put an end to the White Australia policy. This is a proud achievement of Liberal government. And I think over time, its role has changed. And I mean, when it was first started, you couldn't, get on your phone and, get access to news in Poland. That was not possible. That can happen today. People have much greater access to overseas content than they did before. So I believe its role has changed over time as, the news media and technology has shifted over the period. But I think it has always been a great standard bearer about the important role of Australia's multicultural nature. And I think that's what it continues to do so well. And that's why I continue to support it strongly, as I did in the last budget.
We thank you for that. Can you ever see a day where SBS and the ABC merge? That's one thing that a lot of communities fear, that the unique charter, of which we're all fiercely proud, may cease to exist. Can you see a day when that might happen?
Well, look, I'm always open to any sort of public policy question. I don't have a habit of ruling things out, but no one's putting that in front of me at the moment, and it's not an issue that's burning on my agenda to even consider the question. I mean, I think SBS has proved itself to have some very strong management with Haas and the board, who I think are doing a very strong job. But SBS is proudly Australian. That's what I like about it. It's not an amalgam of a whole bunch of different cultures. It's proudly Australian, and I think it provides the opportunity for people who have come from so many different cultural backgrounds to be able to connect as an Australian with each other, regardless of what their backgrounds are. And I think that's one of its great virtues.
We are a very efficient broadcaster, yes. As you know, so there's some very unfashionable merchandise here for you. We know you're rather fond of the Prime
caps.
Ministerial cap.
There you go.
So we've got one there for you, and also an SBS Keep Cup.
That's quite a trendy one.
Well, trendy is one word for it, Prime Minister.
It's got a nice design on that. There you go.
You can add that to your collection, and we do appreciate having you here today.
Excellent.
Thanks very much.
Good on you, mate.
Thank
Great
you.
To see you.
You too.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.
SBS.com.au